are listening to Impact Hustlers, and I am your host, Michael Schaffrath. I have made it my mission to inspire the next generation of entrepreneurs to solve some of the world's biggest social and environmental problems. And for this reason, I am speaking to some of the best entrepreneurs out there who are solving problems such as food waste, climate change, poverty, and homelessness. My goal is that Impact Hustlers will inspire you either by starting an impact business yourself, by joining the team of one, or by taking a small step, whatever that may be, towards being part of the solution to the world's biggest problems. This episode is brought to you in partnership with ChangeNow, the world's biggest event for changemakers, social entrepreneurs, policymakers, and corporate leaders that are working on solving the world's biggest social and environmental problems. Make sure you get your tickets for ChangeNow. It's happening at the end of May already. And go to changenow.world, changenow.world to get your tickets. For today's episode, I speak to Jean-Louis Kindler, the CEO of Waste2H, a company that transforms waste into hydrogen that can be used to power buses, cars, and even forklifts. Hydrogen isn't talked about much anymore since electric cars have taken off, but it is a very compelling solution, especially for industrial use cases. Waste2H enables the local upcycling of waste into hydrogen and solves two massive problems for local councils and communities: managing waste and generating renewable energy. Jean-Louis is an experienced entrepreneur who has been in the space for decades and shares some great insights on how to pitch an engineering-driven company to investors, how to not burn out, and some really interesting lessons learned throughout his journey as an entrepreneur. Enjoy this episode. I'm always very excited when we have founders on the show and executives on the show that use deep technology and engineering to solve really major environmental problems. And Jean-Louis Kindler is the chief executive officer of Waste2H, which uses gasification to transform plastic waste into hydrogen. And I'm really excited to have this conversation with you, Jean-Louis, today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having us here. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to talk about waste, about hydrogen, and about how and what took us to this, on this both long and short journey. But I'm sure you have plenty of questions, and I will let you ask your questions.
Yeah, I would love to learn from your journey. I think you've been in this space for many years, actually, in terms of sustainability, using technology and for promoting sustainability, creating sustainable solutions. And I'd love to start with, how did you first discover the potential of gasifications to actually use waste as an energy source? When did you come across this, and what did you do next?
That's exactly what I meant when I said a long journey. I was living in Japan at that time. I spent about 22 years in Japan. And I was working with a consulting firm who was helping municipalities, local governments, cities, towns to develop circular economy programs to be more environmental. And this company actually had this idea, started to develop this technology, this process, to use construction waste and wood waste to produce hydrogen. And we are talking about the year 2000, 2001. And this is where I discovered gasification as a solution, as a much cleaner solution to handle biomass, and also potentially to produce hydrogen. Believe me, in 2002, when we actually started and built the first prototype, when we were saying that we would be producing hydrogen for fuel cell cars, people would look at us and think we were coming from planet Mars, because there were very few fuel cell cars at that time.
And now I think there's probably still not too many cars, but a lot of buses and kind of public transport solutions are relying on this.
Oh, there's actually a lot of buses. There's about 8,000 fuel cell vehicles that are in operation in the United States only, and that most of them are in California. But a few things, some, a few details that few people know is that, for example, there are 30,000 fuel cell forklifts that are operating in the United States. And that is because, and this is, it will probably last for another few years, but we are having this old battle of the fuel that you can put into a tank versus electricity that you need to put into a battery. It takes time to store energy in a battery. You can fill a hydrogen tank or a gasoline tank in about 5 minutes. And forklifts, lots of forklifts operate indoors. Even using a clean biofuel, like, for example, natural gas generates CO2 and therefore cannot be used indoors. And now with the accelerating world business and world trade and all these things, you have lots of warehouses that literally operate 24/7, and therefore they cannot afford having their equipment sitting idle 5 or 6 hours because they need to charge. And this is why we today have 30,000 forklifts that run on fuel cells, because those forklifts literally work 24/7. And for that, they need to be filled in 5 minutes.
That's a very good use case. Give us a bit of a background around gasification. As I understand, gasification is actually quite an old concept. It's nothing that you necessarily came up with yesterday, but this is something that has been done in the chemical industry and also for producing electricity already. But tell us about gasification and your take on this. How is your solution kind of pushing the boundaries and innovating on gasification?
Yes, gasification has been around for a long time. Town gas in European capitals in the beginning of the 20th century was produced out of coal that was gasified. Town gas actually is the product of gasification. Whenever you cook barbecue with real wood char, you are using the byproduct of gasification. And not to revive bad memories, but the German army during Second World War, I think 1/3 of the fuel that was used then was actually created not only via gasification, but gasification was the first step to produce a gas that was then liquefied into fuel. So Yes, it's an old, well-known, and really reliable solution that has been, it has been around for decades. But the problem is when we talk about processing waste with gasification, then it opens the door to all sorts of horror stories. And literally, there has been quite a lot of problems with gasification when applied to waste processing, because gasification works really great with consistent, predictable, reliable feedstocks. Feedstocks whose quality does not change. And municipal solid waste, obviously, you have a mix of metal, plastic, food, batteries, textile, rubber, everything. And this changes constantly. And one of the keys in the technology that our partner in Japan, Japan Blue Energy, has developed over the past 20 years, is that this process is inherently cleaner than even, of course, than incineration, is even cleaner than conventional gasification. And it also has a major advantage in the sense that the way it is designed, and I will not go into technical details because you'll have to stop me, but inherently the way it is designed makes that this solution is self-adaptative. The feedstock quality variations do not have an impact on the process and on the quality of the gas that we can recover. And this is really important because literally the industry has seen massive gasifiers being stopped because temperature, for example, in the reactor was not high enough. And there was lots of tar being produced, et cetera, et cetera. It comes to a point where we would prefer not using gasification to describe our solution, but we have not really found a good name yet. So we'll stick with the waste-to-H process. The ways to hydrogen.
And you're actually developing two plants right now in California and Tokyo. Can you tell us a bit about the progress you've made and where you're at right now and maybe what the challenges are in building those up?
Absolutely. So this technology, like I said, is about 20 years old. So in the past, we have built 4 successful pilots. And right now, as we speak, we are building 2 additional systems. One that is ready to be installed in Tokyo, and another one that is still in construction that we will have in California sometime around spring this year. I used to say next year, but now it is this year. And so those 2 systems are small size solution. And this is something that is also quite specific with our system, is that we do see the waste to age solution as something that is decentralized, as opposed to the kind of cult around gigantic systems that would of course provide economies of scale, but that also would be difficult to maintain, would not be that flexible when populations changes, when the feedstock quality changes, there might be some changes to be made in the process itself. It's always more difficult to do that on a very big solution or equipment. And of course, last but not least, logistics. When you have a system that needs to be fed 1,000 tons of feedstock per day, that means 100 trucks per day. And sometimes those trucks need to come from far away. What we see and what we would like, and what we are offering is a solution where waste would be processed locally, therefore really minimizing the impact of logistics on the feed, but also producing hydrogen locally, because although, and this is something that's really important to say, really the hydrogen economy is happening. We do see all the stakeholders in this economy that come with innovation, that come with product, that come with solutions. But it's also a fact that today hydrogen logistics remains challenging, and it will probably be challenging for another few years. We strongly believe in local short cycle loops, and that also includes producing hydrogen that would typically be consumed locally, the waste processing center becoming also the hydrogen filling station.
So what I've seen is actually that you just said this is a big part of your strategy to rely on the use of microgrids and actually work with municipalities to allow them to recycle their own waste, produce energy for their own community. And I think you have the first municipalities that are joining in on that mission, is that right?
Here in the United States, there is a scheme called the Community Choice Aggregation Program, which gives communities the possibility to directly procure renewable energy from local suppliers. And there are actually 1,500 communities throughout the United States that have signed for these programs. Initially, it still is a federal level program, but more and more states are signing these programs into bills and make those programs available for the state. And it typically is the kind of environment we are offering our solution. And it really sounds like a marketing word, but it is a win-win situation for municipalities, because municipalities are the ones that have a problem with waste, obviously. They want to avoid sending that waste to landfills. They want to avoid sending that waste to incinerators. Both landfills and incinerators are not much in favor with the public. But since 2017, they also cannot send that waste to China. They do need a solution. Systems like ours are this solution. And on top of this, municipalities also are responsible directly or indirectly for public transportation. That's school buses, that's buses, that's municipal vehicles fleets, that's garbage trucks fleets, and they need fuel for that. So it does make sense for municipalities to actually embrace solutions like ours. that really are the key to them to solve two problems with just one system.
From your perspective as an entrepreneur, what do you think is the biggest hurdle for you at Waste2Age to scale this fast? Is it convincing enough municipalities to buy that energy or help set up these plants? Is it engineering problem? Is it a problem of kind of just creating enough plants and fast enough? What's the biggest hurdle for this to actually succeed and be scaled, ideally globally?
I would not call that a hurdle because I'm way too old to start jumping hurdles. I'm an old entrepreneur for a young company. So I would say the challenge to developing our solution, it's interesting. It's, well, of course, there are plenty of challenges. There are the naysayers who say that gasification will never work. There are some very prominent entrepreneurs who think that fuel cell is something that is for losers. I will not name anyone here. There's plenty of challenges. But really, what probably is the thing that we do see a lot is simply legal, a regulatory environment. Because we are bringing a solution that is particularly about, in both cases, both waste and energy are highly regulated industries. And that's perfectly normal because on the one hand, you have waste, which kind of equals pollution. So it has to be regulated, it has to be controlled because you don't want to spill pollution. You need to manage waste so that the whole world does not become a big garbage dump. And energy, of course, is also highly regulated for financial reasons, but also for safety reasons. And coming in with a solution that handles waste in a way, in a different manner, and that also produces hydrogen, which also is considered as something, or at least has for a long time been considered as dangerous. It means adapting and living with a regulatory environment that is not necessarily the most encouraging, I would say. But things are changing. Things are changing a lot. And actually, probably more than in the United States, things are changing a lot in Europe because governments, authorities are now making massive effort to promote and to support the development of all these technologies. And they do understand that the regulatory environment has to change, has to evolve. So while, yes, it is a challenge, yes, it, in some cases, it could delay some of our projects, I'm absolutely convinced that this is something that we are, of course, that also is being done with the help of industry stakeholders. There's lots of lobbying taking place in the US right now about hydrogen and about hydrogen-related technologies. It's something that we'll eventually, we're living in a, it's, there is this Chinese curse about living interesting times. And we are living interesting times. Those interesting times being a true transition. We are really living the energy transition. It's something. It's serious. We are really at the first days or years of a massive movement out of fossil energy towards renewable energy. It's far from being mundane. It's something that. It will not happen overnight. We are lucky in a way to being part of the first wave. We do intend to ride this wave and to come to the shore and to install a lot of systems because it will help handling waste and it will also help producing hydrogen where that hydrogen cannot necessarily be produced with electrolysis, for example.
My next question is on your entrepreneurial strategy, right? So your personal skill set and background, I think you have a lot of experience in the industry. Obviously, you have experience leading and starting companies, but you're not an engineer, right? For this company, you've actually collaborated with Japan Blue Energy on the technology. And for founders that are listening to this, obviously at the early stages, there's a decision to be made. Are we developing everything in-house or are we going to partner with those that already have developed the technology? Can you share some advice on that and why you chose to partner with a company that has developed the technology versus trying to develop stuff from scratch?
Like I said earlier, yes, I am an old entrepreneur, and I have a lot of company creations and a lot of failures also, because this is what we usually learn from. The way it happened is we did not really choose to work with JBack. I happened to have this experience and this to know the company because we have worked together in Japan. And about 2 years ago, I met a group of investors here in Long Beach in California who were looking for a clean energy solution that would have a significant impact on the world. And for me, it was almost serendipitous. We had this conversation. I said, "Oh, of course, yes, there is JBack in Japan," and that was it. It's not as easy, of course, but finding the technology was not really a challenge. I think for every entrepreneur, what's important is to always keep eyes and ears open and store information, store experience, keep things, and try to. You always create from experience. You don't create from out of nothing. And in that case, it was that fact that 20 years ago, I had been working with this company. I had been involved with this technology. It's a fact that having 30 years career in clean energy and renewable energy and clean tech, I had a few comparison points that taught me or that I know. Because of that experience, I knew that the JBack solution had significant advantages over other ones. But then when we created Waste2H, and it's always the same thing. When you create a company, you need that company needs to have a certain number of functions. We're talking technology, we're talking finance, we're talking operation, we're talking management, human resources, etc. And no human being is an island. We are essentially social animals, and nobody works alone. To be able to work, you have a client, you have a supplier, you have with the kind of expertise I had, which, yes, my background is political sciences, so I could hardly say I am an engineer. But it's also true that with 30 years playing around with technology, I must also confess that I have, at least I think I know what I'm talking about when I talk about technology. But the very first persons that joined the team at Waste2H, the lady who is our COO today, and she's the housekeeper. She's taking care of keeping the company running in order. And because I don't do that, I don't know how to do that. I'm a business developer, and that's what I'm good at. So this is what I will be doing. I in the team, I profoundly trust and rely on the housekeeper as well as on the technology. We also hired an engineer. She's from Sweden, not very far away from you. And her expertise really is gasification. So because when we talk with JBack, who, by the way, is our shareholder, so it's not just a technology supplier, but really the way we created Waste2H, the idea was that we wanted to offer JBack an opportunity to go worldwide with the technology, and to have access to markets and engineering and construction. And this is exactly what Waste2H is doing. Our job is to engineer, build, and sell systems that embed JBack's technology.
Having been in the space, from your perspective, what would your key advice be to, let's say, engineering-focused founders that start, like engineering-heavy companies, not like a quick software startup or anything like that, but like something that's actually having to produce physical things, whether that's like power plants or like your plants, the Waste2H plants or anything like that? What would your advice be for them to be able to do that, but also still move fast and scale fast?
It's extremely interesting because I was discussing that this kind of topics earlier today. If there's a person I consider my mentor, it's an entrepreneur I know very well here. It's a longtime friend. And he has been an investor and a technology marketer in the dot-com industry, software industry, for years. Mm-hmm. And one thing he told me was to be careful not talking too much about technology. And this is what I see a lot with engineers. And I totally understand that. I was doing that myself. I've been doing that myself, even though I'm not an engineer. Talking about technology just could not stop. For hours and hours, you would talk about how great the technology is. It's not what the public want to hear. And it's particularly not what the public wants to hear when we talk about software, because nobody understands a single word about coding and everything. But it's also true in the industry. And my very first advice for an entrepreneur who comes from the engineering world is find someone who will be able to give the big picture and to talk about the technology without talking technology. That's super important. That's super important. It took me long and painful years to understand that and to actually, I think I manage now not to talk about the technology too much, but it really took time. But it's absolutely essential. It's vital. You cannot start a company today. You cannot get investors if you keep talking about technology, because investors, they invest in something that they understand. And there's no disrespect to investors, but investors do not understand technology. What they understand is markets. What they understand is sales. It's commercial impact. It's what you can do to change someone's life. And it's not technology. Of course, without technology, you cannot do it. But it's not by explaining the technology that you will be explaining how you will change the world.
One more question I got regarding your entrepreneurial journey and the lessons learned. You mentioned earlier that you went through a lot of successes, but a lot of failures as well, as probably every entrepreneur that tries to solve hard problems. What were some of the most important lessons beyond the one that you just shared of not talking too much about technology? Beyond that, what were some of the lessons you've learned in your journey that you can share with founders?
Be very careful with your cash flow. I actually bankrupted the company by making it grow too fast. And it feels really bad when you have to lay off people because you were so happy you made that sale. It's bad.
That's really good advice, especially looking at fast-growing technology startups, which often raise a lot of capital. So maybe sometimes that problem gets postponed because you have enough capital to pay the bills until you don't. So I think it's really valuable advice.
And that leads to the other very important lesson, is that never, ever think that you can stop and rest and just let the business go and run by itself. It does not happen that way. Never.
It doesn't work that way, yeah. So it's basically 7 day a week, 24/7 job.
That will lead me to my third piece of life lesson, which is I have a deep distrust in people who say that they work 48 hours a day. I think it's extremely important to keep a balance between work and life, because killing yourself on the job does not do any service to your company. I'm not advocating laziness here. I'm absolutely advocating for doing things when you need to do them. Obviously, it's very important to be responsive. We are using tools, email, podcasts, everything that are almost immediate. So we have to be fast. But it's extremely important to keep mens sana in corpore sano, keep a sane mind in a sane body. That's very important. Healthy mind, healthy body. And you cannot do that if you work constantly.
I think it's so important. I think we can learn a lot. And I see a lot of startups adapting as well. I think it's always intense in the early days, but adapting to a model where there's a bigger focus on balance, work-life balance, obviously attracting better employees, but also doing better work. It's not about moving slower. It's like elite athletes are not running a marathon 24/7. They have time to rest and to train and to rest and reflect, and that's needed
absolutely
for business as well.
It's absolutely obvious that there are times where you need to rush and work 48 hours a day. But it should not be, let's put it like this, it should not be considered as the recipe for success, because this is something I don't believe in.
A very good lesson. I've got one more question for you, and that's thinking about the next 10 years. If you think 10 years ahead, the year 2031, how does the world look like in 10 years if Waste to Age succeeds with your plans?
About 1,000 waste-to-H hydrogen filling stations. Systems being installed at hospitals, for example, where the waste from hospitals, which is dangerous potentially, is not sent on trucks to remote locations to be handled, but is handled without human manipulation, directly on site, destroyed to help producing energy. Waste from communities being processed locally without too many truck back and forth. That community running on the hydrogen that is being produced, of course, not only with our technology. Again, there is electrolysis. There are other solutions. We are here as the part of a whole ecosystem that is currently under construction. I have no intention of dominating the world, but we do see ourselves being a significant stakeholder in this whole hydrogen economy, hydrogen infrastructure. That again, it's very important to emphasize. It is happening. It's not a question of whether will hydrogen be used someday. It's hydrogen is being used now and will be used tomorrow, and it will be increasing.
Thanks very much for sharing both your technology, your journey, and your entrepreneurial expertise with us today. And it was really good to have you today. Thanks for making the time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share the episode, leave us a review, and consider becoming a supporter on buymeacoffee.com/impacthustlers. This means a lot to me. Thank you very much for tuning in, and see you next time. Bye.